Well, good afternoon. My name is Sandy, and I am an alcoholic. And I am qualified to be here. And you'll hear that in a moment. Something's buzzing. Is it me? Can anybody else hear the buzzing? Can you? Oh, good. Okay, because I hear things. I heard something in the room, and I told Chuck I hear something, and he couldn't hear it, and then finally he heard it, and I was so glad. But I'll make the... there it went away. Whoever did that, thank you. Yeah. it's back. Okay, here we go. Now, Cornhuskers, this is absolutely marvelous. You people are unbelievable. I know this has been said by some of the other speakers, but it's just, I've never heard a welcome quite like the welcome you give. Chuck and I have enjoyed our stay. We came in on Thursday. We drove in and got here at about 4:30 in the evening. And it was a very nice drive. It was pretty coming here. I never realized that there was so many hills. I always figured Nebraska was going to be flat. And I mean, it was a lot of hills once we turned off of 35 and onto whatever it was we were on. And I was hoping that I could use the cruise in there, but I couldn't, so I had to watch my speed. I like to do the driving, and I'm a better driver than Chuck because he doesn't drive fast enough. And so I have to use the cruise because I tend to speed. But anyway, I love Nebraska. This is beautiful. I'm going to do okay. I have my friends from Michigan over here. Yes! And they're going to keep me in line. You know, I have a tendency to kind of roam around, and I ask them if I get off track, and I say, where am I? One of them volunteered. In fact, I think all three of them to let me know where I'm at. So you're in luck there. I have a few thank yous that I'd like to say, of course, to Dick and the committee for asking Chuck and I to come here. I know Dick made the contact, did a very wonderful job at letting us know where we're at and what we're supposed to do, and sent out letters. Mike, where is Mike? Could you stand up, please, and just stay standing? Mike is hosting us. And handsome man. Stand up, keep standing. Because he's very handsome, he's available, he works. Working his program, has a sponsor. Anybody out there needs one? Ella! Did I do it right? Did I do it right? Okay. Nice fella. Been very, just available to Chuck and I, and anytime we needed him, we just knew he was there. Renee, I don't know if Renee is here, but I haven't seen Renee in so long, and I don't know her last name, but she, good one for, are you in here, Renee? No, she's not. She said she had to work at 3, but, huh? Just left. Oh, okay, sweet gal. I knew her from Duluth. We went to quite a few meetings together, and a good friend of hers that she sobered up with is also a very good friend of mine, and just a sweet gal. You're lucky to have her here. And all the speakers. I've just absolutely enjoyed this. Something that I've realized is you know, how we're all the same. You know, all our stories just kind of go together. And you know, I even though I wasn't, you know, Nancy was too smart, well, I was too dumb. And, you know, I was not quite as dumb as Tim, but I was too dumb. but we all have those likenesses, you know. And it's nice today to realize that I have those same, the same, you know. I always looked for the differences before. And they just been a wonderful experience to hear all of you. I never realized anybody could talk for 3 hours, and I agree. Whoever said when it was done, I said to Chuck, I wanted a couple more hours. He cheated us. You know, that was just marvelous. It began on August 11th, 1947. That was the day I was born, and that was the day I believe I just started to self-destruct. And I do it yet today. I just do. You know, I like to say that I have a very serene recovery, but you'll hear in a little while when Chuck tells his story, I do not. You know, I have, I'm very happy, joyous, and free today, and I'm very grateful for that, but I'm not always terribly serene. And it is, you know, your sobriety, a great life. It is a great life. I did not think it was going to be that when I came to you. When I came to the first meeting that I ever went to, all I really wanted was the smile that the woman across from me had. I had not smiled like that in years, you know, and thought, boy, if I could get that right there, that'll be enough. You know, today I have that smile most of the time. As somebody, as Pat had said, most of the time, 99.9% of the time. You know, I can look you in the eye and I can smile and be happy. Today I'm coming to you in kind of a funky mood. Something has been going on. I have no idea what it is. I talked to my sponsor about an hour before I came here, and I've talked to her a couple times this week already, and I don't know what's happening. I have no idea. Something in my mind is going amok. And usually when it does that, I have fun, and I haven't been having fun with this one. So I hope that I send you a message that's a joyful message. I said to you that I came into this world with self-destruction, and I came into a family that was very much like some of the families that have already been talked about. My home was an extremely religious home, but it was not a home that was practiced. The religion wasn't practiced within the home. It was an alcoholic home, but I too never saw the drinking. My father quit drinking when I was 3 years old, put a plug in the jug. He went to a few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and immediately judged you as a bunch of SOBs and that he didn't need you. And he went on his road of recovery in a very strange fashion, but yet there were some things that I learned during that, not while I was using, but after I recovered, of how not to stay sober. His example was a very fine example of how not to. And but then he had a couple of things also that I had to see that were good. And one of the things that I realized that my dad did to help his recovery was he wanted to pass on sobriety when he had it. I never did see him drink, but I know there was times when my dad did. And usually those times he would kind of eliminate himself from the family. And Dad spent a lot of time out in his garage. And, you know, we just kind of knew to stay away from him at the times when he was in those moods. And I hope once I recovered that I didn't get that type of thing. I'd like to say I did that 100%, but there are some times I get in moods and my family doesn't want to be around me. And I try to get to lots of meetings when that happens, so I don't say and do things to them at those periods. Anyway, when another thing Dad would do in his recovery is every Wednesday, my mother would go to what was called the Mission. And it was on Tower Avenue in Superior. It was where a lot of the bars were, the north end of Superior. That's where I was raised. And they had, in the front part of the Mission, my mother would have her missionary guild. And she'd bring her Bible, and she'd bring a couple of us kids, and there would be all these ladies there, and they would come up and tweak our cheeks. And we too, are a kind of a musical family. Like Doug mentioned, and a couple of people had mentioned music. My dad could pick up any instrument that there was, and he could play it. Never read a note of music all his life, but he could pick it up. He could hear somebody, hear a tune, and somehow either plunk that or blow that or play the harmonica, whatever it was, he could figure out how to play that instrument. He was just a fantastic, very intelligent, creative man, my dad was. But he was alcoholic, and aren't we all? But he So, and Mom would, we kind of inherited that as kids. My mom was very musical, too, and she could read music, and she could play piano, and she could play guitar, and she had some kind of a thing that went around her neck and went out like this, and then she plunked on that. I don't know what it was. Things would go up and down and twing, twing, twing. Very, very pretty and sing. And I can't read music, and I can't play piano, but I can sing. I can sing when I need to, and... So Mom would take us kids along to that missionary guild, and she would have us sing to the ladies, and they just thought it was wonderful. These little kids would sing. And my dad would take his Bible, and he would go in the back, and they had a place where there was cots and things in the back of the mission, and that's where all the little winos would be. And he would go back there, and he would read the Bible with those winos. And my mom would say, "You kids, stay away from there. Don't go back there. They're filthy pigs. Don't go back there." You know, well, all she had to say is not go back there. And I mean, I got an alcoholic mind. I haven't drank yet. I couldn't wait till she was looking away, and I snuck back there. And you know what I saw? I did see winos, but I saw my dad sitting there, and I saw him sharing. I saw him giving a message. And it may have been his message, and I may, early in sobriety, thought it was the wrong message, but it was his sobriety, and it was his message. And it made me realize that that is a very important part of sobriety. So it's more the reason why I'm here today, and besides the fact that, some, like somebody said, when you were asked, you say yes. You know, I kind of, that ticks me off. But anyway, so... I saw Dad doing this, you know, and I absolutely loved drunks, you know. I didn't know a lot of them, but there was a lot of them in my family. My dad's brothers, I think, the only brother he had that was an alcoholic was one who ended up taking care of all the rest of the alcoholics and their family, you know. I don't know much about my mom's side because my mom was... adopted, and she has never learned anything about her past, so we don't know much, but I got the feeling there's probably some in her family tree, too. And so our home had it had the ism, you know, as I've heard a lot of Al-Anon speakers talk about, you know, the ism. And I remember as a young kid wondering when I'd be walking home from school, and I'd think, okay, I wonder what I'm going to hear, you know, and I liked if I heard noise, if I could hear them yelling, because that was kind of predictable. You know, you knew that either she was throwing something. Dad wasn't violent, but Ma was. You know, Dad has meat fork, or what do you call them? Holes in his shoulder. Yeah, as the marks where the meat fork went in, and she just liked getting a little bit on the nasty side when she got angry. And so I would listen. That was kind of predictable, you know, that. But when I approached the house and it was silent, that was frightening. You know, I didn't know quite, you know, okay, when are we going to be able to talk? When are we going to have a meal together? Are we going to have, is Ma going to be up in our bedroom sleeping? Is Dad going to be out in the garage? You know, so I'd go play through my mind what was going to be like. And, so I didn't know which part was worse, you know. And I thought, boy, I tell you, when I grow up and have a family, I sure am not going to treat them that way. That isn't going to happen in my home. Well, we all know it did. You know, one of the things that my father had a hard time doing is he had a hard time showing affection. And for years, I never approached my dad and for a hug or a kiss or an I love you. And it was just kind of expected that you knew he loved you, but I never saw it in the actions. And I really enjoyed whoever said, whichever one of you said today, that the actions were there. He did he when he went to work and did the second job and took care of us. My dad worked his rear end off. He worked 2, 3, sometimes 4 jobs, you know. And we were a poor family, and Dad wasn't, he was educated, but he was alcoholic, so he never really followed through with anything, so he always took these little piddly jobs, but he worked hard. And I remember he has a little girl saying, okay, if I want to be with Dad, I better go to work with him. So he had jobs that I could go to work with him on, you know, if he went to do some electrical work on somebody's house, I'd crawl in those crawl spaces, and he'd say, okay, just keep pushing it to, you know, and I'd feed the wire down. And I remember one time he had his call to a big, I don't know what it was, but it was someplace where there was huge, huge furnaces that were really, really big, as round as, well, not quite as round, but they were big round things that you could stand in and walk, and he had to clean them out. And I got to go 3-4 days with him and clean those furnaces out, come home and blow black stuff out of your nose and out of your ears. But I was with Dad, you know. And that was important to me back then. And that was something that after I started using that I started resenting. You know, why did I have to do those things to be with him? You know, why couldn't he have been home and be a real father? He was a real dad. And it was sobering up and working the steps that gave me that freedom to realize I had a real dad. Laughter. I love the laughter that happens in these rooms. I love the laughter. I love the tears, too. I love the laughter that happens in meeting. But when I came to you, that was extremely scary. I don't like my laugh. That's part of the self-pity. But I really don't like my laugh. I have a laugh that's... The teacher that I worked with... yikes. He just passed away a couple months ago. We were, excuse me. We worked together for 7 years, and I was his assistant, and we worked with students with disabilities. Chuck does also. And Kevin and I worked in a room together 7 hours a day, and I worked with children that, I don't know if anybody in here works with children with disability, but they become your children. You know, they love you so unconditionally. And we not only would do things in school together, but we went on Special Olympic, you know, field trips, and so we'd plan for them, and we'd have special events that we'd have that would get fundraisers for these. And so I became very, very close to Kevin and Mr. K. That's what the kids called him, Mr. K. He used to always tease me about my laugh. And he called me Betty Rubble. And when I first started going to AA, there was a gentleman named Bernie, who was another fellow who just passed away this year. He had three deaths that have been kind of emotional. But anyway, he was a fellow that I've gone to meetings with for years and years. And when we first started going to meetings together, when I laughed, Bernie would laugh. And then he came up to me one day and he says, I want to thank you for your laughter. You've helped me to accept my daughter. And I couldn't understand at all what he was talking about, but he says that when he was using, his daughter laughed just like I did, and he hated her laughter. He just hated the way she laughed. And I said, well, I can't blame you when he told me that. And he says, but, you know, Since we've been going to meetings together, and Bernie came in about 6 months after I did, and he tells me that I was instrumental in his early sobriety, and I believe him, but I don't know how. But anyway, he had said that being at meetings with me and hearing me laugh helped him realize, if I can enjoy her laugh, why can't I enjoy my own daughter's laughter? And he started finding his daughter's laughter a joy. Now, isn't that something? You know, I don't know if you find that a miracle, but I do. I find that an absolute miracle. God does not mess around. He knows exactly what he's doing. You know, he takes something that I thought was, that I didn't like, and took it and created it to be a freedom for another person. You know, and today it isn't quite so bad, but, you know, at times when I, like last night, Doug said something and it made me laugh so hard, and then I start the snort thing, you know, and then I get embarrassed. You know, So I do try to cover it up still, you know. It isn't a real feminine thing.
Yeah, but oh well.
What you gonna do? You got what you got. You know, but I love the laughter that happens in these rooms, and I never had that, you know. Humor is a real important part in my sobriety and in my recovery, and it was a very important part in my selecting the husband that I have today. The first time that I met Chuck, I could not remember much about the evening, but what I remembered is he had the best sense of humor that I had ever been around. And I thought, I've got to have that man. That man makes me laugh. That man makes me happy. And I did. I got that man. And, you know, I did it in all the wrong ways, but I got the man. So you do those things. I want to go back. I kind of jump around, so I hope I don't get too mixed up here. And I have a tendency to start a story and then go into another one and not finish this one. Figure it out. It's okay if it's not right. Who knows? It's, you know, they can be creative, actually. So when all these things were going on at home, and then as I got into be a teenager. Dad did something with all of us girls, all three of us girls, is that when we became teenagers, it's like he stopped having anything really to do with us, you know, other than to bawl us out for something. And I learned after I sobered up and asked him about it, it was like when we became teenagers, in his mind, then it's mother's turn to take care of the girls. You know, dad takes care of the boys, ma takes care of the girls. My mother was a very sick woman. she didn't know how to take care of the girls. My mother's solution to every problem was to give you an enema. That's the honest to God truth. I don't care what it was, if it was a toothache, a earache, a bellyache, a footache, a sliver, anything. Have you had a bowel movement? You know, and you know, to this day, I mean, nobody touches my rectum except a doctor. That's it, you know. It's mine. And that's my mom had bizarre solutions for everything, you know. That one I did not bring into my home. My children never had that way. The doctor said, this child needs to have, it's bound up, needs to have a laxative. I'll give it a laxative. You know, but in my home, the home I was raised in, you have the toilet here and the wall here. There was an enema bottle there. I thought everybody had that decoration in their bathroom. It never left the wall. It honestly did not. You know, it had the little fixtures down on the floor here, because then when us girls became teenagers, then you had to douche. Yeah. So for some reason, my mother felt like that always had to be clean. Everything had to be clean down there. Oh, Lord. So I had some really weird upbringing. It was a bizarre home, and I, you know, all this all went together with the religion. I had no idea, but I couldn't wait to get out of that home, you know. And I did. At 18 years old, I had a girlfriend who had an apartment, and I didn't tell you about my first drink. No, I got to go back to 13. I was always very, very shy. Never really liked talking to people. I would have a friend, but they say that alcoholics do that. We don't have relationships. We take hostages. So I had a hostage here and a hostage there. And I had this girlfriend of mine who we were real, real close. And she had an older sister who was in the practice of buying liquor for younger kids. This friend of mine approached me one day, and now in this religious home, I learned that you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't, of course, sex is, you don't swear, you know, and you're not even supposed to think dirty thoughts. Well, I had already thought dirty thoughts, and I had had sex, no partner yet. But, yeah, and so this girl had approached me and asked if I wanted to drink with her. And I knew I was already had, you know, one couple checks against me with the thoughts and the actions. It was clean, though. We know it was clean. So anyway, I thought, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can, but I thought, you know, it why not? You know, let's give it a try. And so I went over to her, and we went to her girlfriend's apartment. It was on a Saturday night, and in that time, in the 60s, they had dances every Saturday night for teenagers. And I have a beer, or go to the dance. And we went to her sister's apartment, and beer was my drink of choice right till the end, till my, you know, that's why I drank, was beer. I drank other things, but I liked beer, although I did not like the taste of beer, if that makes any sense. But beer was easier to drink. The little drinks, those fancy drinks that some people drank, they just seemed like they went so fast. They were gone and boom, like that. Whereas a beer you could get 3-4 swallows out of. It didn't go that fast. Yeah. So anyway, Chuck was always amazed at how fast I could drink those big glasses of beer, the big glasses. Yeah, they were cool. And so I took that can of beer, and I tasted it, and I thought it was the most horrid stuff I had ever tasted. And I drank about a half a can of it, and then it did what the big book talks about. It started giving me some freedom. It went, wow. Wow, you know, like, who's ever said that? Russ said, woo, you know. Yeah. I became sexy, and I became friendly, and I became everything in my mind. I did. You know, I thought, wow, boy, I want to go to the dance and have some fun tonight. And I used to go to the dances and have fun, but it was always frightening fun. You know, if I saw a boy approaching me to dance, I'd all of a sudden have to go to the bathroom. It's all I was doing, I got to go to the bathroom. And I would dance with my girlfriends, but very much afraid to dance with the boy. And well, I drank that can of beer, and I thought, all right, let's go. So I said, I'm ready. And my friend, her name is Squeegee. Squeegee said, you know, you got another 5 beers to drink. I mean, we got a 12, I mean, we got a 12 pack, we each got a 6 pack. You got to finish that beer. And I said, well, I don't think I can. I mean, this one is enough for me, and it feels wonderful. And I think if I drink any more, I'll throw up. And she said, if you don't finish your 6 pack, the next time that I have my sister get beer for me, I'll share it with Sharon or Julie, and she started naming off friends. And so I finished the 6-pack. I mean, you have to. At 13 years old, if you don't know where you're going to get your next drink, and there it is, I'm telling you. Yes. And I threw up. It was horrible finishing, and it really honestly was. It was very, very hard to finish that 6-pack. But I had to. So, and then we left for the dance. I don't remember getting there. But I do remember during the dance, I had a lot of fun. I danced with boys and girls and the pole in the middle of the room. And, it was wonderful. And but the people that chaperone the dances, I had gone into the restroom, and evidently they thought that I didn't look right. So they sent this lady in, and she approached me, and she says, have you been drinking? And no, I'm not a violent person. I can get myself out of a tough situation, and I have had a few fights, and usually won. And but I didn't like what she said, and so I hit her. And all I remember is seeing blood. And she left, and they sent 2 cops in to get me. Which I thought was not very well becoming. I'm a little thing, or I was then. I was only like about 95 pounds. And they sent 2 policemen in to take me out. And I, too, thought, you know, I was frightened at first. And then I thought, got to be cool, you know. I knew I was going to be coming out of there, and there was going to be a million people looking at me, and all my friends, all my, what was it, chaps? No. All my mates were going to be out there. I like that, mates. So, are going to be out there seeing me come out of this bathroom with these two cops. And so as I came out and I had one on each arm, I'm waving, you know, waving to my friends. And off they took me to the police station, brought me in, and they put me in. The chief of police was there on his desk, and then some chairs, and I passed out on the chairs, and they had called my father. And when Dad came to get me, he was not happy. And what he did is he grabbed me by the hair and pulled me up. And what it did was it started everything rolling again, and I threw up on the chief of police's lap. And that didn't go over very well either. So, yeah, that was my first experience drinking, and it seemed like that was kind of the route that it took. You know, I don't ever remember really drinking and not getting drunk and throwing up and passing out. I thought blackouts were normal. I thought normal drinkers had blackouts. You know, I just thought that was what you did. You went out, you drank, you forgot where you were, and then you next day wish that nobody would tell you. You know, and then when they did, you were hoping that it wouldn't be too bad. You know, and I really thought that, you know, the next morning, I remember waking up, and it was on a Thanksgiving, and I remember hearing Mom and Dad downstairs, and Dad saying to my mother, "Boy, that little girl was sick. That little girl learned her lesson. I don't think we're going to have to worry about this happening again." And my ma being quiet, and I think my mother knew it was going to happen again. Because I had a brother who was alcoholic, and my brother had done these same things. I have a sister that older sister, I don't know if she is, but... Or I should say she doesn't know if she is. But she exhibits a lot of the same things. And I think my mother saw it. I think my mom saw it, you know. And she was right, because it did keep happening. And I'm not saying I drank every day, because where do you get, you know, at 13 years old, it's difficult. But I will say that every chance that I got, I did at that young teenage age. And every set of morals, like somebody had talked about, everything within me that had a sense of morals to it was gone within about 2-3 months. I did do the smoking. I did start having partners when I had sex. Yeah. And it was like, you know, this is really, really not exactly what I had planned for my life. But it was a lot more fun. It just was a lot more fun. And I thought, well, I'll just keep having the fun and learn how to do the drinking right. And school started getting bad. You know, I was fairly athletic. I was on the tumbling team and enjoyed being athletic. And that stopped, you know, because I was afraid that eventually I'd be caught at some party and then I'd be kicked off the tumbling team. Just seemed like everything was going down. All the kids that I said I'd never hang around with, started hanging around with them. And we've heard that before, too, in the stories. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. You know, I quit school. I started skipping. My mom, you know, they call in the truant officers. I had a friend who lived a few blocks away, and I would go over there, and I'd... stay at his apartment, and one day I was at his apartment, and there's a knock on the door, and it's opened up this sweet little old lady, and she asked if he was home, and I says, "No, but I'm his cousin. I'm just cleaning his house for him today." It was his grandmother. I know. And such a sweet lady. She says, "Oh, well, okay, I'll be back. I'll come back." Sweet lady. Never said anything. You know. So, but those are the things we do. You know, you lie. You know. And one lie covers up for another lie. But then my mom started driving me to school, sitting there, watching me go in school, and I'd stand there and watch her leave, and then I'd go. Well, so eventually it was just easier to quit. I mean, there's just too many games. And so then at 18 years old, well, closer to 19, that's when I met Chuck. And he's going to be your Al-Anon speaker, and you just are in for a treat. If there's those of you that don't come to Al-Anon speakers, come to this one. And there's a lot of others. There's a bunch of you that are in here. You're going to do something. Oh, I don't listen to that. What do they have to say? A lot. So anyway, when Chuck and I met, and we were going to get married, and this was going to be it. This was going to be my ticket to happiness. And he was a good drinker. You know, Pat talked about being, you know, a good drinker. Chuck was a good drinker. He was also a wonderful, wonderful enabler. I mean, when he started getting too drunk, then he'd stop and start drinking pop because he needed to take care of me. Isn't that a riot? You know. And then here's the funny part about it is I got ticked because he wasn't drinking. But the poor man just had to quit drinking so he could take care of me. You know, but being alcoholic, I get mad because the heck's the matter with you? So I'd quickly try to find a way to get away from him. And sometimes it would be just go to the bathroom and sneak out the back door. And sometimes I left him the car and sometimes I didn't. And, and we started having these babies. Chuck and I started having babies. I thought, this is going to be it. You know, I'm going to be really happy now because I want to be a mother. Being a mother was my dream, is to be a mother. And so I had, at the time, we had Chucky and Chris, and Chucky was walking and Chrissy was just a little baby. And I tell this story because it's very important for me to remember why I'm where I'm at and why I have to stay here. Chuck was working midnights at the time, or afternoons, I should say, and so I'm in charge of these children. And the next morning, I couldn't remember putting them to bed. Well, I always remember putting them to bed, but I couldn't remember putting them to bed. They were bathed. They had clean pajamas on, and I had to have done it. Chuck wasn't home. That frightened the daylights out of me. You know where it talks in the big book about sometimes there's those moments of clarity? That was a moment of clarity. Of course, we never follow them when we're still in the practicing stages, but there was a moment of clarity there that says, something's wrong here. Something's wrong. You must have drank into a blackout, and you don't remember putting those kids to bed. You love them. I made a decision that day, and the decision was that I would never drink in that home alone with those children. Wasn't that a wonderful decision? We make such sacrifices when we're practicing. And I pretty much stuck to that. If there was nobody there, then just don't, because if I didn't pick up the first drink, then I wouldn't have to worry about whether I'd pass out and those children wouldn't be taken care of. But if there was somebody there, then it was okay. You know, and as they got a little bigger, they were irritating children. and if I had a friend over and they wanted to drink with me, then what I'd do is sometimes is I'd take my beer up into the tree, and you can see far quite a ways up in a tree, and see where the children are and drink my beer. I see them. I know where they are, and I always came down before it was too. Before I had to fall down. I knew I was pretty close to falling down to get out of that tree. But something that would happen then is like towards the evening after the kids were in bed, and then I'd climb back up the tree. Why? They're in bed. Nobody needs to. They're being watched. They're cared for. And I thought, somebody would be there. A neighbor would be around or something. You could justify anything. And I climb up in the tree, and if it was a hot evening and it's getting close to dark, I would do it rested. I'd start taking the clothes off. It is a beautiful experience to sit in a tree naked, if you've never done it. And breeze blows through. Birds look at you like you're nuts. But anyway, I love nature. I love nature to this day. I have not sat in a tree naked sober. I have not. I have not tried to be a seagull since I've been sober. I've been a little loony, but I have not tried. And one night that was a, you know, it's funny how these ideas come to your head. Like I said, they just come to your head. And I remember one night, walking down Tower Avenue, which is our busiest street, and I was, saying, I wonder what it feels like to be up on the top of that light pole. So you climb the light pole. that makes sense to you. It wouldn't be Al-Anons, but it would be alcoholics, And I haven't done that in sobriety. I have not prostituted myself for a cup of coffee. No, I borrowed 35 cents. Well, you can't do that anymore. You can't get 35 cents for... Yes, you can. You can get a cup of coffee for 35 cents on Tuesday night at the St. Williams Group out in Foxborough, in Wisconsin. And because we passed a second basket, we asked for 35 cents for a donation for coffee. If you don't have it, please enjoy the coffee anyway. Anyway. That type of things tells me that drinking gave me was a problem in my life. I haven't urinated in public. Somebody else said that. I haven't urinated in public since I've been sober. I go to the bathroom. I close the door. It just makes sense. it made sense to do it wherever you had to go before. Dealing with resentments. I am so grateful that I learned how to deal with resentments today. I remember I was very active in PTA, even when I used, I'm going to be involved in my children's life. I was very much afraid when I sobered up that their teachers and the other parents would find out that I was not so much that I was alcoholic, but that I was a member of AA. and how people in AA are now. Are they going to find out that I'm a member of AA? Well, I used to go to their conferences with liquor on my breath. I used to go I volunteered in school in the reading program. Isn't that wonderful? And I mean, at that time, aren't I wonderful? And I'd go there and read with these children with liquor on my breath. And I'm wondering, their teachers are going to be find out. They knew. They already knew. The neighbors knew. I was afraid that the neighbor would find out. They knew. Now this is one of those times I rely on you. Where was I? Do you remember? Did the neighbor find out?
They knew.
They knew. But what else? Why? Where was I before that?
PTA.
What was I doing at PTA? My God, I can't remember. Well, I knew that. Okay, let's just start all over from someplace else, okay? Because I honestly don't remember. Boy, oh boy, you've heard this story a million times, Chuck. Why don't you tell me where I was? Okay, all right, so we'll forget that part. Let's get on something else. But I don't know where to go. Okay, I'll look down here. Pardon me? That's it. Thank you. Resentments. Don't do that again, guys. I rely on you. Please don't forget again. My God. Oh. Anyway, so I was at the resentments. All right, takes a woman. I'm sorry, fellas. You're doing a good job. So what I did, I was in PTA, and there was a lot of women in those PTA that really ticked me off. So one night, my sister and I were in a bar, and we were talking about these women who ticked us off, and I said, let's get back at them. So what we did, 3 o'clock in the morning, is we rode around to the yards of the women that we resented, and we urinated in their yard. I think of it today, I mean, dogs do that. We take our dog for a walk, and that dog marks his spot constantly. I'm marking my spot, and in a couple of them, we yelled out what we thought of them. And, I don't know why nobody ever called the cops, but that's something else I have not done since I've been sober, is if I resent you, your yard is your yard. I have no right doing things in your yard that are not okay. And And being able to have conversations in my family, being able to have, you know, the Big Book talks about where we have these family discussions. I'd like to tell you our family discussions have always been family discussions. We've had family arguments, and that part in the Big Book where it says that you say, this is going too far. We need to stop. We'll talk about it later. It's not exactly how it goes, but that's usually what I'll try to say. And the first time that I did that, I was so excited, and I went to my meeting, and I said, I told Chuck to, and we'll talk later. And I'm so glad I followed the Big Book. And the guy that I said it to says, I didn't see anything like that in the Big Book. And he opened it up, and he says, where does it tell you to tell him to off? You know, and shut up. And it says we're going too far. You know, and eventually, I learned how to say, I've got to stop. I'm going to start calling you names. I'm going to start telling you to do an obscene with an animal, act with an animal. It's up there. It wants to come out, so I need to stop right now, and hopefully we can talk later. You know, I learned how to do that. My dad and I, I left that out earlier. My dad and I, as I became a teenager, and I started resenting him for, you know, for not giving me the attention that I should have as a teenage girl, and wondering what I did wrong, you know, for him to ignore me. I had a big, big resentment at him, and so him and I just started locking horns, and we became enemies. And he didn't like the way I treated my mother. He had a right to. You know, he treated her the same way, but he had a right to. And he had a license to treat her that way. Isn't that funny? I tell you, you know. But he didn't like that when I would swear in front of my mom. My dad's nickname for me was Potty Mouth. And early in sobriety, when I'd go to visit him, and him and I would start talking, and before you know it, we'd be arguing, and then he'd call me a potty mouth, and I'd leave, and I'd, you know, cry. And one day I left, and I went to my sponsors, and I told her, he did it again. He called, I don't know why I go visit him. All I want to do is have a relationship. And she said, Sandy, tell me exactly what happened. Tell me exactly what happened when you went to see your dad. So I told her word for word what happened, and she looked at me and she says, you know what? He's right. You are a potty mouth. And at that time, she told me I was not to go and visit my father. I couldn't stay visiting with him if I was going to start swearing. So the minute I felt like I was going to start swearing, leave. If I felt like I was going to start arguing with him and I couldn't swear, stop that conversation, leave. And then she also said that I had to kiss him goodbye and say, I love you. Which, that was another thing that was really difficult, because my dad didn't want to be touched. You know, it was okay if he did it, but not to be approached and touched. He had that armor. Well, it started out the first time that I did it. You know, and I did. I left. You know, going to be. We were going to argue, so I left. And I quit, kissed him on the forehead, said I love you, left. Next time, you know, kissed him on the forehead, said I love you, left. Next time we got to stay a little longer and a little longer. And eventually what happened is Dad started saying I love you back. First it started with, yeah, me too. Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Eventually he started saying I love you too. And then eventually he stood up and we hugged and we kissed each other on the cheek. You gave that to me. You gave me a father that would give me hugs and say I love you. And early in sobriety, one of the things that I was afraid of, you know, I had said to somebody, I want to find out, you know, I don't know if my dad loves me. And I asked him, why don't you ask? So I asked my dad, do you love me? And he says, of course I love you. I'm your father. And it didn't make any sense to him that I was asking him if he loved me. Because, of course I love you. I'm your father. You know, and so to have it grow into a relationship where he could say, I love you, is a beautiful, beautiful thing. When I went into that marriage, I brought that, of course you do, you're my husband. Chuck would say, I love you, Sam. I'd say, well, of course you do, you're my husband. And it was cruel. It was absolutely cruel. I didn't know it was cruel. You know, and today I know he loves me. Isn't this the oddest thing, how you can say something and not cry and all of a sudden cry. See, this is the funky mood. I apologize for the funky mood. Whew. Today I know Chuck loves me because Chuck loves me. And today I know Chuck loves me the way he does because of the program of Al-Anon and because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I know my children love me. And today I know I love my children. Today I know my sisters love me and my brothers love me and that I love them. The first year of my sobriety, my brother Raymond was going to come home. Raymond left home when I was only maybe about 5 years old. He was much older than I. And my brother Raymond, one of the things that he brought into our home was he brought in laughter and he brought in love. He just has that ability. He still doesn't. And he could make my mother happy, and he does yet today, just by walking in the room. And the day when he left, my mother withdrew, and she became so, she just became so depressed and couldn't be reached. And I resented my brother Raymond so bad. It took me many years to realize why I resented him. But I resented that he left, and he seemed to be the only person in that home that could make her feel the way he did. And that's okay. But yet, I didn't try to change that. I didn't try to make her, well, I did try to make her happy, but the more I tried, the worse it got. And then I'd resent him. Well, a year in my sobriety, Raymond was going to come home, and I was so afraid of him coming home. Oh, God, I was afraid, and I talked to my sponsor about it. She said, well, what are you afraid of? And I said, well, I don't know. I really aren't. I don't know. I think I'm afraid that I don't know how to love him. I'm afraid I don't know how to tell him I love him. All over again. I mean, I had the experience with Dad, and yet I'm experiencing all over again with Raymond. Well, to make a small story short, I mean, big story short, whatever. When Raymond came home, I said, I love you. He said, I love back. We hugged. And all that time, I worried for nothing. You know, it amazes me how this mind will have me worry over the most ridiculous things, even yet today, like that. You know, that's something will be approaching. I worried my butt off over this thing, you know, because I'm in this funky mood, you know. My dad and I, as I said, got that beautiful relationship, and Dad was a snuff chewer. Oh, it was just gross. Our house, another thing that we had besides the animal bottle, is we had coffee cans everywhere. Everywhere in the house. Coffee cans. And even if you bought Dad a nice spittoon, which we did, we got him a couple really kooky. Well, he didn't want to use the spittoon. It's too pretty. So those were just decorative. But he had these ugly coffee cans, and our cupboards in the kitchen had all these black balls because when Dad didn't have enough money, he'd take these horrid, dusty, and the cobwebs would be going from one to one, but he'd chew them bloody things. Oh, my God. So every car had streaks down the side because after toot, you know, and the streaks down the side of the car, all his shirts had stains, you know, and people would bug Dad about chewing. And I remember realizing a few years in sobriety, I should leave him alone, you know, like it says in the big book, they smoke, leave him alone. You know, so I stopped bugging him about his snuff chewing. But one of the things Dad used to say to me is, or everybody would say, you know, I could get killed quicker crossing that street right now than I can by this box of snuff. Well, now this you may think is nothing to make fun of, but my dad got hit by a car crossing the street to get a box of snuff. That's how he died. Yeah. So he was right. But it was the snuff that took him. Yeah. And it made me think, you know, how we are. You know, we will make those excuses. You know. And the day that this happened to Dad, it happened to be mine and Chuck's anniversary, and we were at an Al-Anon. They had an open Al-Anon speaker meeting in Duluth. And we were over there, and our neighbor knew where we were. She was also a woman from Al-Anon. She came in and tapped me on the shoulder and called me out. And I knew by the look on her face something was wrong. And she had said that Dad was in the hospital and he had got hit by a car and that we need to get there right away. And up there, he was all hooked up with all kinds of things, and he was real puffy right here. It's everything just so I knew something was really bad, you know. And, his neck had been broken. I had him on all these life support things, and we did all the phone calls, and I had called my sponsor and, you know, and a few people from AA, and Chuck had called some people if he needed to call. And so we were waiting for family members to get home. And there was several hours that had passed because it was, you know, they were in different places and around the United States. And one of the experience I had is I knew I needed to find some place where I could have talk, just me and God. You know, I wasn't happy about this situation, but I also wasn't sad. And the reason I wasn't sad was because I had 11 years with my father. Of hugs, of I love yous, of arguments, of chances to make amends. He and I would talk about the big book. He didn't particularly care about this program, but he would let me talk about it. And he would talk about it. He had a big book. I think my dad read that thing. I really do. He may not have practiced it the way we do. But I think my dad tried the best he could to stay sober, and I think he tried to be a happy sober person. But you know, if you don't have a constant recovery program, it's hard to do. And I found a place in that hospital where I could look over Lake Superior, and we live in a beautiful place in Duluth Superior. And I looked out over that lake, and I just had prayers of gratitude and thanks to God. For Alcoholics Anonymous, for the relationship that he built with me and Dad, and walking me through this thing, and then for my family, that he would, you know, guide them, for the ones who maybe didn't have a relationship with him, that he'd walk it with them. And it happened. Went back and all the family members finally got there, and we had a chance to all have our few minutes with Pa. And I was standing over him and looking down, and I just told him to say hi to Grandma and Grandpa and Mabel. Mabel was a very good friend of ours, and I just knew Dad was going to see him. He was lucky. Yeah, he was a lucky man. Because I think my dad was going where he always said he was going to go. He was going to go and be with his Creator. And I was grateful that he was going quick. You know, and he had been having some little TIAs, and the people who had witnessed the accident had said it looked like he just didn't know what he was doing and kind of stepped back into a car. So he may have even had one of those little TIAs at that time. And he always used to say he didn't want to end up having a stroke and being a burden. So he went quick, and that's a blessing, an absolute blessing. So I'm very grateful to you folks for giving me that time with him before I got to say, he's yours. Prayer. Let me talk to you a little bit about prayer. I probably left something out, and I'm not asking the fellows from Michigan anymore because they're trying too hard to listen. I love you fellows. Prayer. I'm going to tell you about prayer. When I was a young child, and we were Baptists. Let me tell you, Baptists know how to pray. You betcha. And I had a girlfriend who was a Catholic, and a squeegee was Catholic, and she used to pray on her beads. I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever seen. I'd go over to her, and her mother would always say, "Squeegee, don't forget to say your prayers," and she'd pull out her beads and Hail Mary and Mother of This and Mother of That. And do all her prayers. And I just thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. So one day, I picked up my mother's pearls. And I started doing this. She goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm praying. I'm praying." And squeegee prays like this. She slapped me across the face. She said, "Don't you ever do that again, Baptist. Don't pray like that." Well, I knew. Yeah, if I'm ever going to pray, I better pray right. You know, I don't know if there's any Baptists in the background watching. And so, well, when I, the year I, that, that, year when I was started drinking, I also stopped praying. You know, that was when I stopped praying, stopped going to church, the whole ball of wax, like Pat said. You know, it was no longer enjoyable. Well, it wasn't terribly enjoyable to begin with, but anyway. And so I just abandoned that prayer idea thing. And I remember when I came to AA and they talk about prayer and meditation, I thought, man, oh, man, I don't know. I don't do that anymore. And I don't know if I can do that. And so the sponsor that I had at that time had said to me, she says, well, I'll tell you what to do. Just memorize the third step prayer. And I looked at her, as sincere as could be, and I said, I cannot do that. I'm a Baptist. I've been praying since I was 13, 14 years old, other than please get me out of this one. You know, and here I'm telling her I can't do that, I'm a Baptist. You know. And but I did promise her I would. She was a kind of a hardcore lady. And I was afraid she'd hurt me if I didn't memorize it. We went on vacation at that time and I brought my big book and all my books and so we were at this cabin, rented this cabin on a lake. And I think, well, one of these days, I've got to pick that book up and memorize that prayer. And, oh, okay, maybe today, no, maybe tomorrow. And, we're going to go fishing. Now let's go swimming. And just didn't want to do it. But some of you people will remember this and some won't because you're too young. But there's a Little Rascals movie where there's a kid who was acting up in school and he wanted to go fishing. And he knew if he acted up, the teacher would kick him out and then he could go fishing. And the whole time he was fishing, all that kept going through his mind is learn that poem, learn that poem, learn that poem, because he couldn't come back to school until he learned the poem. It ruined his fishing. That woman ruined my vacation. I kept saying, learn that prayer, learn that prayer. I learned the prayer. She never did quiz me. You know, and I resented that. It took like about the first 4 or 5 days of my vacation. Away from me before I decided, well, I better do it. And that gal left the program about 9 months into my sobriety. She went to a religious organization. I forgot to check my time. Oh, my word in heaven. 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 5 minutes? Okay. She went on vacation. She went to a religious program. She took all of her girls. Listen quick. She took all of her pigeons with her, except me and about 2 or 3 other gals, and they all did. I don't know what they did, but I stayed, and another gal stayed, and I went for a year without a sponsor. Got as sick as could be, got myself another sponsor, and that gal started working me through the steps. The first one I didn't get the opportunity to do that with. I went through the first 4 in treatment. And then didn't go any further. This second gal, boy, she got me into the big book. We had to read every week. She had me doing another 4-step. Beautiful, beautiful experience with that one. We went out in the middle of nowhere. She says, where do you want to do it? Do you want to do it at the club, my house, your house? Boy, oh boy, I got to get so quick. So we went to, I says, well, I don't want to go to a house. I want to go out in the woods. So what we did, we went to the Nemadji River, which is a place that I wanted to kill myself in at one time. And we went, walked through the woods. Her and I got on our hands and knees, held hands, and said the third step prayer together. I felt it. And then she heard my 4th. She listened. You know, I took that 5th. And then she gave me some directions, like it says, to do. And I went home and did those directions and did have something that I had to call her back with that I had forgotten, you know, And what a beautiful experience. And I've had that experience many, 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 many times. That gal, too, also left the program. But the difference was I didn't wait a year. I immediately got another sponsor. And that sponsor did the same thing. Because, well, we're going to have to do a 4th and a 5th. And, you know, and did many with her. And everything hasn't been roses, though. I'll tell you that right now. 13 years into our sobriety, Chuck and I had a really, really... which is my sobriety date, by the way. I'm so sorry. May 18th, 1980. Yeah. And it was Mount St. Helens went off that same day. I didn't know that. Chuck did. He's the one who told me that. So, okay, where am I now again? Okay, yes. So, So I had gotten another sponsor, and she walked me all through these steps all over again. And Nancy was just a marvelous, marvelous lady. She passed away about a year and a half ago. And I immediately got another sponsor. In fact, I had gotten another sponsor even before she died, because she had been sick, and I knew I needed to have another sponsor. And 13 years of our marriage, Chuck and I had some really rough stuff going on. 13 years into sobriety, I had some rough stuff going on. And I needed to leave for a little while. I knew I didn't want to leave him. I loved him dearly, and I didn't want to leave him, but needed to get out of the house and just get some things in my mind figured out, and not really figured out, but do some fourth and fifth stuff. And did move back home, and we did some counseling, and we're still together. You gave us that. They say that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon doesn't save marriages, but I do believe that the working of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon in those 12 steps saves marriages, because it saved ours. And it's saving it yet today. There are some days I don't know how he can stand living with me, because I can't stand living with me. But we have 12 wonderful steps that help us through that. And the sponsor that I have today, when I asked her, it came about, we were at somewhere up in northern Minnesota, and we were speaking. I can't remember if both of us were, but were we both speaking? I can't remember either. Anyway, she walked in. And she's a person that I had thought about. If I need to get a sponsor, I believe I'm going to ask Carol. Here she walks in. And she wasn't going to come there. She hadn't come for the roundup. But her husband, they're book sales. They do book sales over the Internet. And so they came to look at the archives display. And her husband was the archivist of northern Minnesota for several years, and the Minnesota delegate. And anyway, so they were there to look at that. And I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said she would. And she says, but I have some criteria. And my mind went, I've got 25 years of sobriety. Don't give me this criteria crap. Honest to God, that's what the back of my mind thought. And I went, okay, what is it? Thank God the mind, now that my mouth won't say exactly what's in that mind. I just pause when agitated and doubtful and ask for the right direction. And she says, well, I want you to call me every week. I want you to make sure you go to your home group every week and get to at least 2 meetings a week. Get to a big book meeting. And I have been doing all that already, so that except for the calling every week. And at first I thought, that isn't fair. That kind of puts me out of the way. It's wonderful. I've had her for my sponsor now for a year and a half, and I'm glad she's got me calling her every week. I never did that with any of my other sponsors. I called them regularly. Well, usually I saw them at meetings, but this gal lives in Aurora and I live in Superior. And just a really neat relationship is happening there. I'll try to make this quick now so I can wrap her up. La, 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 la. Okay, on page 155 it says that we are painfully aware of being somewhat abnormal. I've always known that. You did not have to tell me the first time I read that I knew that. So, okay, I relate. I'm just painfully aware that something's abnormal. And the cease fighting anything, I try very much now not to. I pick my fights, And I'm so grateful I can pick my fights. If it's not worth arguing over it, I think somebody had mentioned that, don't argue over it. And then I trust the directions. Somebody had mentioned that. Trusting the directions. And I do that yet, I question it, and I question it, when I'll get a direction. But then I just trust it. And I'll do that even with knitting. I have I'll look at a pattern, and I'll go, this doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. And then I'll bring it to the store, knitting store, and I'll say, I'm not quite understanding this. This has to go here, go here. And the layout, the woman at the store will say, trust the directions. Isn't that a riot? Trust the directions. It happens in everything. So today I trust the directions, and I get them at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get them from my sponsor. I get them from my children. We had a stick shift car that Chuck taught me how to drive overnight, and I had to drive it to work the next day. So every time I get to a stop sign, I'd look to see if there was no cop, and then I'd go through. I did that with my daughter one day, and I said, "Now, Chris, don't you dare do this." I said, "Because you'll get stopped by a car." I said, "But I'll do it until I learn how to drive this thing correctly." You know what she said to me? She said, "Mother, you are not, how'd she say it? She's, Ma, you're not going through a stop sign. You are passing up a learning experience." This is a 13-year-old kid telling her mother, "You're not going through a stop sign. You're passing up a learning experience." Today, I don't pass up the learning experiences most of the time. I had a real hard time with my oldest boy, in early in recovery, and I was afraid that he would be resentful at me being in recovery. I was afraid he wouldn't understand alcoholism. I wouldn't understand AA. This is a poem that my boy wrote me when he was only 11 years old, and that boy had never read a book. He had never been to a treatment center, but that kid lived in alcoholism, and so he knew exactly what was happening in my mind. And let me read this to you. It says, "My mom has a problem of drinking, you see. It started in her early 23s. By 33, she started to see what a problem drinking was coming to be. So she went to the doctors to see if they could help and stayed at the hospital to see what life's about. She met a lot of people like you and me. It's a horrible world for a drinker, you see. They get down on themselves and you and me. I hope there's more people in this world, you see, that instead of drinking booze, they're drinking pop, milk, or tea." My kids taught me how to live simple, how not to pass up learning experiences, how to love. You people taught me to listen to that. You gave a husband back a wife. You gave a mother back to some children. You gave a daughter back to some parents. You gave a sister back to some brothers and sisters. You gave a friend back to some friends, because I've made some old friends, acquaintances with old friends. And you've just given me a wonderful, wonderful life. And I just thank you for letting me come today and sharing this. I hope I didn't disappoint the Michigan boys. Fellas, guys, wonderful, wonderful people we are. Thank you very much. Please stick around and listen to that Al-Anon speaker. He's much more elegant than I am. It's a better laugh, please.